Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service. Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hi, everybody. I'm Kiko Bourne, and this is Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in D.C. Every Monday at noon, I spend lunch break with advocates, doctors, parents, and more to hear their agenda for the food system and ask each guest for one action our listeners can take to change things for the better. You can see pictures of the show at Kiko Buff on Instagram and links we discussed during today's interview at kikosfoodnews.com. You're tuning in today for the third episode of our Breadjucation series, and we've covered a lot of ground so far. In the first episode, we talked with a Maryland farmer who grows and mills wheat, rye, and other crops, and drives his grains an hour into D.C. so urbanites like me can enjoy baking with fresh flour. We also heard from a nutrition scientist who referred to a grain kernel as a superfood. Then in the second episode, we talked with the, quote, Steve Jobs of bread, Jonathan Bethany, who bakes at Salu Bakery and Mill in D.C., and his team, with whom I work as director of Breadjucation. Beyond selling bread and whole grain pastries, our mission at Salu is to forge a local grain community in the Mid-Atlantic region. So now it's time to zoom out a little bit. Today, I want to uncover the history of growing and milling grain in this region. And I want to also explore which grains can grow here moving forward and why. So I'm pleased to be joined in studio by two experts who will breaducate us. But first, as always, Kiko's Food News. First headline of today. How scary is this? Or maybe you might be inspired and excited for it. Amazon plans to use artificial intelligence modeling to eliminate waiting time for food deliveries by predicting when you want to eat and ordering a meal for you. According to a patent just issued to Amazon for, quote, predictive restaurant ordering, their model will anticipate customer needs based on a variety of inputs, like past orders, calendar appointments, location, your caloric intake for the day thus far, and the amount of exercise a person has had. So we may have differing thoughts about whether that's innovative or intrusive. Second headline. A New Orleans pop-up food truck has an interesting approach to teaching customers about historical racism. Tunde Wei, its proprietor, presents his guests with two options to pay for their vegetarian Nigerian lunch. White customers can either pay $12 for lunch or the suggested price of $30. Black customers, on the other hand, are charged $12 and are given the option to collect the $18 paid by a white patron as a way to redistribute wealth. After he gives customers their options, he asks how much they want to pay. So I'm curious to hear whether any of my listeners have thoughts about this. One friend I was discussing it with told me he thought it was an oversimplification of an intensely complex issue. I see it as an extremely creative way to invite face-to-face dialogue. That's really important. But curious, feel free to comment on Instagram or my blog about your thoughts. Finally, one more plug today for the Glen's Garden Market Accelerate Her competition, which stops accepting applications this Saturday. So again, if you know a local female food producer creating products within the states of the Chesapeake Bay watershed, give her a heads up to apply to this new business plan competition for food entrepreneurs. I'm on the judging panel, and I can't wait to learn about new retail-ready food businesses that have applied. So I have the link at kikosfoodnews.com, and you can find it at glensgardenmarket.com. We're going to take a quick break, and when we're back, I'll introduce today's guests, Steve and Jason, and we'll start talking about the Mid-Atlantic grain community. Stay tuned.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass. Discover Compass, America's first modern real estate company. By pairing the industry's top agents with technology, Compass delivers an incomparable client experience from the first-time buyer to the seasoned seller. Visit them today in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, or navigate compass.com day or night.
Welcome back to Lunch Agenda's Breducation series. You're joining for part three, where we'll dig into this notion of a mid-Atlantic grain community, what it's looked like in the past, and what possibilities it holds for the future. I'm Kiko, and today I have two experts in the studio with me, so let me introduce them to you. I have Jason White here, who comes to us via the Grassroots exhibit at the U.S. National Arboretum in Northeast D.C. That's at least how I found Jason. But Jason is a faculty member of the University of Maryland's Plant Science and Landscape Architecture Department and director of its Field and Variety Trials Center. His research involves developing and analyzing agronomic production practices to increase yield, reduce input costs, promote water and fertilizer use efficiency, optimize carbon and nutrient cycling, and improve crop, soil, water, and air quality. Jason is clearly busy, and I wonder whether he agrees with this feeling I have that we need more scientists doing that work. So thank you, Jason, for joining us today.
Thank you, Kiko. It's very good to be here.
Great. And we will get talking with you in one moment. On his side, I'm welcoming Steve Dryden, who's the executive director of Friends of Pierce Mill, located in the heart of Rock Creek Park here in Washington, D.C. Over his years of service to Pierce Mill, Steve has worked on the mill's fundraising, special events, publicity, and historical research. A former journalist, Steve wrote the first book on the mill and the Pierce family, which is called Pierce Mill, 200 Years in the Nation's Capital. It was published in 2009, and I've really enjoyed poring through it. The pictures in it are fascinating, and I'll share some of those on my Instagram as well. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So before we start learning about history and science today, I want to take a pause to reflect on a couple realizations I've had thus far over the course of our Breducation episodes. First, it occurred to me that while all but one guest in the former series on Lunch Agenda so far, the Groceries for All series, the Food at School series, have been women, all but one guest in Breducation have been men. And that just strikes me as noticeable. Any thoughts on why that is? Why are the people involved with grain and baking and grain science men?
That's a really good question, Kiko. I think right now the USDA came out with a study recently saying that about 33% of the farming community are women. But that's been really a growing statistic. Historically, it's a man's field, and it's tough work, it's long work, and generally, you know, these are very traditional people. They come from what might be called traditional family values. So the men had men's roles and the women's had women's roles. But that's changing. So hopefully we'll get more women in the field in the future.
Right. Agreed. Thanks, Jason. Steve, any thoughts?
Sure. I mean, a fun fact is actually that at Pierce Mill in Rock Creek, we have a woman miller. That is the person who is actually running the machines and talking to visitors. Her name is Jean Miner. So she's Mrs. Miner the miller. And she's been there for 5 years. She's actually a Park Service ranger who has been trained by other millers to run this very amazing industrial complex, which is what it is, basically.
Very cool. I look forward to meeting her. Mm-hmm. So to take it a step further, thinking kind of thematically or broadly about bread and what I'm noticing, there are so many puns and symbolism in bread. You know, I've struggled to not be too punny in these episodes because they just come naturally. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to a friend about bread and circus and how the Roman government felt they could keep the people down by providing them with the basic staple and, you know, circus being entertainment. So bread has since then stood in for power. And then we get into the notion of a breadwinner and pondering whether men are more involved in the grain and bread field for the same reason they've traditionally held the breadwinner role. So there's just so much meaning to bread, and that kind of sets us up for talking about the meaning of grain in Washington historically. So we'll start with history. DC listeners may have passed by or even been fortunate enough to step inside historic Pierce Mill, right in Rock Creek Park. It's one of the few remaining symbols of Washington's agrarian past, and it's currently become a center for learning about the early technology of flour production for those of us who wouldn't have maybe another touch point. Steve, your book shares the history of the Pierce family, who began as farmers and millwrights and rose to become civic and business leaders at the turn of the 20th century. Why do you think the history of the mill is so important, and how did you get interested?
Well, you know, it's an extraordinary story about people who came to Washington before it was Washington. They actually came in the 1780s and 90s. They were Quakers from the Quaker heartland of Pennsylvania, up near Philadelphia. And they had the good sense or the luck to come here and buy land before Washington was declared the national capital. So they were very well situated when there was a need for flour and bread. And they grew their business and became actually big landowners along the Rock Creek. And they also were dealing with, growing wood for timber and that kind of thing, you know, so they did well. I got involved in this because I'm a local boy. I grew up in Arlington, actually. I've always been fascinated by running water and stones and stonework. So the mill is this incredible, sturdy stone box. It's been there for more than 200 years. Survived floods, fire, you know, you name it. So when I've heard, this is almost 20 years ago, that the mill had broken down and there was a volunteer group starting up to actually try to raise money to fix it, I got involved. I just volunteered.
And you told me that you even have memories of going there with your, I think you said your father and cousins maybe, and picking up bags of cornmeal and rye and meatmeal.
Yes, yeah. My father and his cousin used to go there back in the 30s and 40s and get cornmeal. That was before I was born. But it's a memory that they have recounted to me, so it's a great connection to have with that place.
Right, right. I'm going to be reading a couple short passages from your book. You wrote early in the book, "The miller was America's first industrial inventor. He was a builder, banker, businessman, and host to the countryside. When there was a mill site, there was a nucleus for a town. America had so many Millvilles, Milltowns, Millfords, and other towns named after original mills that the post office department sponsored the changing of many such names to stop the confusion." Can I admit I'd never stopped to think that Milford, you know, for me growing up it was Milford, Connecticut, mm-hmm. was a mill-named town. It says so much about our country.
Yes.
Hundreds of years ago.
Well, and the need for flour, you know, and bread, the staff of life, of course. You know, back in the day, 200 years ago, every village had to have a mill because there was not an economy that was producing flour for sale in the way that we think of it today. And so any creek that was decent sized was going to have a mill on it. And the guy who did that well was going to prosper. And the Pierces were just really good business people, and they were lucky to be in a place where the water was flowing regularly and dependably, because, you know, if you're on a creek that went up and down a lot, you'd be in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So they did very well. And, you know, this mill is the only one left of eight. There were eight of them in Washington, D.C. on Rock Creek, and the rest of them either got burned down, went out of business, but they stayed in business until 1897, which was actually the point at which there was already an economy of flour from the Midwest coming in.
It's just so neat for those of us who use Rock Creek for jogging or picnicking to think of that creek as the, you know, epicenter of industry mm-hmm. in this town back then. I read this quote from your book. "Wheat grew well at the edge of the Piedmont, where soils were more suited to that crop than the Tidewater's earlier mainstay, tobacco. In addition, It made more financial sense to trade in wheat, since once ground into flour, it was a compact, more easily transported commodity. By 1810, milling was Washington's second most important manufacturing enterprise, with annual production valued at more than $200,000, so the first being tobacco.
Well, yeah, tobacco had been the mainstay of the local economy.
Mm-hmm. And one interesting part of this history is that the Pierces were slave owners, right? They were, did you say, the biggest slave-owning family within
D.C.? The second largest slave-owning family in the district. Now, it's interesting. They were Quakers, but by the time they got to Washington, they actually had been ejected for other offenses from the Quaker faith. Mm-hmm. And they adopted the local mores, you know, and culture, which was a slave-only culture. Washington was a slave territory at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
and they actually had to free their slaves early because Washington, D.C. had the first emancipation in 1862 before the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. So we have a lot of documentation.
Right,
on that
I saw
period.
You know, the notice of, yes, of a slave that had run away that
right.
they had, you know, advertised a reward
yes.
to find. And
yes.
Your book talks about that Washington was one of those cities where there were freed African American people who had to live in fear of being taken back and
right.
you know, captured by slave owners.
Right.
So I loved what you shared about Georgetown. You know that mm-hmm. Georgetown was this source of renowned flour. You talk about a man named George Shoemaker
mm-hmm.
and how he was named the flour inspector of Georgetown. And you said Georgetown had its own municipal government and created this the flour inspector post in 1808, an acknowledgement that the milling industry had become a key part of the local economy. Shoemaker's skill at grading flour and ensuring a quality product was of such renown that Georgetown's brands were demanded in all parts of the country. So what happened? You know, I've read one stat that by 1840, there were 23,000 mills scattered across the country, and today there are 200. You know, of course, a lot has changed since then, but why did the wheat and milling industry move from this region into the center of the country? What happened?
Well, I'm not a big expert on that, but part of it's just something we all know, which is that there's a lot of land out there in the Midwest, which is flat and very rich soil that was, once it was cultivated, could produce a lot of grain.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it made more sense to have the production facilities there in those states.
Especially once the Erie Canal and Transcontinental
yes.
Railroad
right.
was established.
So that quickly became an enormous growth industry. And as I was saying, by the end of the 19th century, the mill here in D.C. was actually just grinding grain for feed for animals, rather than for local, because they'd already, you know, there was already an economy of scale to bring in flour, I think. And some people are still using it locally.
And then moving into the 1900s, the mill was still selling grain. You know, I you said that in 37, it sold more than 3,000
right.
pounds of cornmeal,
yes.
700 pounds of wheat flour. There was a great quote from one of the millers that was the miller that was working there in the 40s. I just love this. He said, "All the women work, and when they come home, they warm something to put on the table. Nobody has the time to bake anymore. Another 20 years, women won't know how to cook." So he
right.
was almost, you know, foreshadowing the downfall of cooking and baking at home. And what a
indeed.
Gendered comment.
It's well, it was a very gendered comment, but he was onto something because,
yeah.
indeed, everybody was forgetting how to cook and everybody was forgetting how to bake. And that's one of the reasons we were really excited about reviving the mill and reviving the tradition of local flours, because, you know, this is something that people are now interested in again, cultivating their skills, just like Jonathan from the local Salu Bakery.
Right. So I was going to ask you to just quickly share what you and Jonathan have been talking about in terms of planting seeds from some of the 50 heritage grain varieties he has his hands on and seeing how those grow and being
right.
part of the research.
Yeah, we're hoping to partner with him on that because that would be fantastic. We already have a historic orchard at the mill because the Pierces were also big orchardists and they also grew all kinds of nursery plants. So we would love to have a small patch of wheat and corn and other varieties there for demonstration purposes and to let Jonathan experiment and see what he can do here in the local, you know, soil.
Right, right. And so to build on that, the last question I want to ask you is how Washingtonians can today can get involved with the mill and can either see it in process milling grain or, you know, what's the best time to visit? How can we learn more?
Well, we're at a great time of the year because in April we'll be reopening full time, and that is Wednesday through Sundays.
With Madam Miner,
yes, at the helm, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., Wednesdays through Sundays, 5 days. And then we actually have demonstrations of grinding at the millstones on every other the second and fourth Saturdays of each month from around 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. So if you go to the website, friendsofpiercemill.org, you can get more details. And just remember, so you don't get confused, it's P-E-I, not P-I-E, P-E-I-R-C-E, friendsofpiercemill.org.
I saw on the sign in front of the mill that someone had to correct that with a little sticker over the I-E.
Right, over the years.
Clearly often confused.
You know, over the years, the Pierce family spelled it many different ways. We decided, the Park Service decided about 20 years ago, we were going to go with the most predominant spelling historically, which is P-E-I-R-C.
Okay, noted. Thank you very much, Steve.
Sure.
And so I'm grateful for you being here because you're making accessible to those of us who live a modern day life here in Washington a field, an industry, a past that we wouldn't otherwise be exposed to. And that's what I love about our second guest, Jason, as well. Jason, I like to go to the Arboretum with my family to walk in the azalea gardens and see the bonsais. And it was soon after I started working at Seilu that I noticed some tracts of land there that were planted with barley. And I was curious, and my digging led me to you as one of the experts behind the grassroots exhibit at the U.S. National Arboretum. Can you tell us about the exhibit that you worked with Jeffrey Reinhardt at Maryland on and the goals of the exhibit there?
Yes. Well, I worked with Jeffrey Reinhardt. He got the whole thing started. He helps maintain both the turf grass section of the exhibit and also the ornamental grasses and agricultural grasses. And by agricultural grasses, I mean the seed-bearing grasses like wheat, rye, oats, barley, triticale, all those are on display there at the National Arboretum. And he also works with, for example, sugarcane. People might not realize is an agricultural grass, and that's where we get most of our table sugar from.
Yeah, you told me that 4 of the 5 most critical food crops worldwide are grasses.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for reminding me. The most critical one is corn. And we help him do not only a grain corn display, but we put some popcorn in there. And the whole goal of the exhibit is really to get the public a little bit more interested and involved and aware of where their food comes from and the different types of varieties that are out there. That's why we plant a lot of, you know, oats. Everybody has a handle on oatmeal. And so if they can see what that looks like out in the field, then maybe they'll get a little bit more interested in where their food comes from.
Absolutely. So just to share with the listeners, those 4 grasses that form the you know, pillars of our diets internationally are wheat, rice, sugar, and corn. Those are all grasses. You told me that you speak to grains from an agronomic standpoint, and I asked you to explain to me what that means. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah. Agronomic is more of a distinction between row cropping versus horticulture cropping, where agronomic crops tend to be planted mechanically, they're harvested mechanically, and they have a definite growing season, where horticulture crops tend to be put in greenhouses. A lot of times they're planted by hand and also harvested by hand. Those would be like tomatoes, sweet peppers, watermelons, those types of things.
And so your focus is more the row crops.
Row crops, which would be the small grains that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. Corn, soybean. We're also looking at other cool season grains like camelina, the canola, mustards, flax seeds, those kinds of things. But the big ones are, in addition to the 4 that you mentioned, Wheat is really big in the Mid-Atlantic region. Barley is less large, but it's growing. And then, of course, a little bit of rye.
Right. And how has wheat evolved as a grain, you know, in terms of its structure and how it's grown over the past few centuries?
That's a great question. One of the things that I did at the National Arboretum was plant what I'm referring to as an heirloom wheat. This is wheat that it was dates back to the late 1800s in Pennsylvania. And that heirloom wheat is taller. It tends to do what we call lodge more, which means it falls over and makes it very difficult to harvest mechanically. It has a little bit more of a smaller seed head, so the endosperm ratio to the bran and germ is a little lower. And then it tends to be, it yields less. It tends to yield about 30% less than these modern types. So how that's changed over the years, there was a fellow by the name of Norman Borlaug who really pioneered and he was one of the fathers of the Green Revolution. He implemented dwarfism in wheat, and that was a good thing. What it does is it makes the plant smaller, their stems are stronger, so they tend to be able to be harvested mechanically a lot better. Their standability is a lot better. And then their yields are higher, too. They yield about 30% more.
Right. And if you were advising a farmer in this region on what to grow, what would you tell her to grow? Notice the her. What would you, you know, what is going to be, you know, I think it was you who said farmers are business people, of course. Based on the climate, based on the varieties available and the market even, what would you tell her to grow?
That's another good question, Kiko. I would tell her to grow what she could make money on, not just in this season, but also in the future. And as you mentioned, because the farmers have to support their families, and so if they can't sell it and make a good market for it, then they're not going to be in business for very long. Aside from that, it really depends on what their available mechanical resources are, what their labor resources are. If they have access to a combine and a whole lot of land, then they can go large scale and go for, say, wheat. Generally, what we grow is something called soft red winter wheat,
right,
which goes into cookies and pretzels and those kinds of things.
Yeah, we use that at Salu a bunch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. However, if they want to go organic, then they need to have even more diversified cropping system. But there has to be a market for it. So it's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. So the organic market is relatively small, but there is a built-in market for standard conventional wheat, barley, rye, those kinds of things. So it depends on what their local market is that's available.
Do you know within the organic market which grains are in the highest demand these days?
Actually, some of the really big ones are wheat, actually. Organic wheat,
right,
and organic barley is very big. And a lot of that is used for animal feed. So that goes directly into the organic turkeys, organic chickens that you may buy at the grocery store. Also, organic corn, organic soybeans are really very big. One of my technicians is an organic farmer on the side, and those are the main crops that he grows.
Well, that's helpful to have him on your team.
Yes, it is.
So the last question I want to ask you is, for someone who wants to eat grains grown in this region, because I figure you have kind of a pulse on who's doing that, where would you tell them to go outside of Salu, of course, because they know that, but where else do you have on your radar?
Salu's a really big one. I have to put a bit of a plug out to a guy named Anson, to Greg Roberts at Anson Mills.
Uh-huh.
He's in North Carolina, and he gave us what I'm referring to as George Washington barley. So they actually recovered the same type of barley that George Washington used to grow. And we're scheduled to plant that out in the National Arboretum either late this week or early next week.
Exciting. Once the temperature isn't literally freezing in D.C.
Yeah, the soil temperature has to be above 40 degrees.
Okay.
And then we can plant.
That's exciting. I will definitely look out for that.
Great.
Please send me some pictures and I'll share them. I hope that over the course of our Breducation series, we've made a compelling case for the power our listeners have when they go to buy or bake bread. We have choices between grains grown in a way that nourishes the soil versus grains grown abroad on huge monocrop farms. We have choices between flour complete with all of its original bran, germ, and fragrant oils versus flour that's been sifted and treated. And I just want to echo something that scientist David Killalay said in the first episode of Breducation. He said, "The nutrition industry has been trying to promote better eating for decades. The nice thing about wheat is, since bread and grain is such a big part of our diet, the kind of flour we're eating could make a major impact on our health." So before we close out Breducation on Lunch Agenda, I want to take time to ask each of you for your action item. What's one thing our listeners can do to personally change our food system for the better in a way that you think the food system stands to be improved? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. Well, I'd like the audience members to do their part to stimulate a public dialogue towards not only an increased interest in agriculture, but also science education and research.
You told me that you're planning to march in the March for Science?
The March for Science in
March
April.
March for Science in April. So just turning up the volume on scientific conversation, which is clearly your passion.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And to put it in perspective a little bit, the U.S. military budget is somewhere around $600 billion, where our R&D budget is less than a tenth of that. And so I think that if we put more money into science and science education, then we can try to figure out the causes and remedies for these world problems before it becomes a military issue.
Well said. And when you say our R&D budget is less than a tenth, who's our?
The United States and what the U.S. Budget spends on research and development.
On research and development. Great. Thank you. Steve, over to you.
Thank you. Well, I would just say that it's very simple, you know, eat more whole grains. And it's not hard to do that because there's a stamp on all kinds of products from the Whole Grains Council, which
right.
says this is whole grains. And related to that, be thankful that we have whole grains. Have an attitude of gratitude and remember that our daily bread.
Thank you. That's inspiring. For pictures of today's interview, please check out my Instagram, which is KikoBuff, and Pierce Mills' Instagram, which I've been really enjoying lately, which is friends_of_PierceEI_Mill. And if you share this podcast across social media, please include #LunchAgenda. Next Monday, we'll dive into a piece of the food chain I believe the average person knows least about, but is most at the mercy of, which is food distribution. Dun, dun, dun. I'll see you then. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.